This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try and get a better understanding of what this is, what it is we're doing to try to make certain that we don't have an outbreak of BSE in the United States, and whether indeed those measures are enough, whether they go far enough. And our guest for the program is Sheldon Rampton. He is an investigative journalist. He is editor of a publication, a quarterly publication called PR Watch, which is put out by an organization called the Center for Media and Democracy. He is also the co-author, along with John Stauber, who also works there at Center for Media and Democracy, of several books, including one that was published in 1997 titled Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here?, published by Common Courage Press. Their other books include Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies in the Public Relations Industry, and the most recent, which has just come out, is Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. That just came out January of this year. As we talk with Sheldon Rampton, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, all we ask of anybody's welcome to call, but all we ask of callers is people just, you know, try to be brief so we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. Mr. Rampton, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. It is, as I read, it is thought that BSE in cows is something that a small number of cows simply are going to get, but that this outbreak that we saw in Britain was not so much a matter of spontaneous development of BSE in individual animals. It had to do with a practice that I think probably a lot of people were really not aware of, and that is that it had been the practice for parts of some animals to be ground up and processed and made into food and feed for other animals and fed to other animals. And it seems to be the case, what people seem to think, is that one of these kinds of spongiform encephalopathies, one that affects sheep, were in the sheep were put into the feed, they were fed to the cows, and that's how this happened. And then it accelerated when parts of cows were fed to other cows. Is that what we think about how this started?
Well, I've been listening to you describe this, and most people make a lot of mistakes when they try and discuss this class of diseases because it's pretty complicated, but you've done a pretty good job except for one detail.
Okay.
Which is, it's true that a number of scientists think that this disease started in sheep and then moved into cows, but that's not at all the consensus or even the majority opinion. And one alternative theory is that the disease occurs spontaneously in cows themselves at a low level that was previously not detected because it is so rare, and that natural disease in cows got amplified in England as a result of the practice of feeding rendered cows back to cows. So there's a debate over whether it started from sheep or whether it actually started from cows themselves, which, given some of the peculiarities of this particular class of diseases, is perfectly possible.
Well, let me ask you one further question, and that is again, based on what I read, there is this suspicion that what we have identified apparently is some of these transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, these TSEs, in different kinds of animals,
right.
In sheep, in cows, in human beings, and also in some other things, elk, deer, mink, cats. But I gather that some scientists seem to think that it may be that all mammals, that they occur in all mammals, particular ones for particular mammals, but that it is something that is rare enough so that it's difficult to see, and so for that reason we might have missed it. But there may be a lot of these TSEs out there that we just don't know about.
Right. In fact, a couple of studies have been done of Alzheimer's patients. These are small studies, but you shouldn't try and generalize from them. But when they've looked at people who've died of Alzheimer's in the United States, somewhere between 1% and 14% of the cases they looked at actually turned out to have a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. So there might be a considerably larger incidence of this disease in humans than we are generally led to believe. It's what the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies are is a class of diseases which create a dementia similar to Alzheimer's, which is ultimately fatal, and it does that by sort of filling the brain up with these microscopic sponge-like holes that can be detected upon autopsy with a microscope. But because the disease resembles Alzheimer's, it's possible that Alzheimer's masking the true incidence of the disease, and that a number of people with this disease are being misdiagnosed as Alzheimer's patients.
Mm-hmm. There is a TSE that affects humans, and that is the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, so named for a couple of German scientists who identified it in the 20s.
Right.
And it, like the others, again, you know, what I read says, like the others, it's something that we don't really quite understand, but we think perhaps it occurs spontaneously in a small number of people, like one in a million, and that it primarily is a disease that we see in older individuals. But we have, since we've now seen this out, this concern about BSE, we have seen a variant of this disease which operates differently, which seems to be cropping up in younger people, producing, I guess, the same sorts of symptoms. And the question is this something these people got? Is this, in fact, BSE manifesting in a human being and something that these people came into contact with because of something, some food item that they consumed?
Right. And the general consensus among scientists who study these diseases is that the young people you're talking about did get the disease from mad cow disease, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. The reason that this is something of a dilemma for scientists to study is that this is a very bizarre class of diseases. When you talk about it occurring spontaneously, for example, I can imagine if there are doctors listening, that some of them, if they're not already familiar with the unique characteristics of this disease, would think that's nonsense. Diseases don't appear spontaneously, especially transmissible ones. There's got to be a virus here, and if there's a virus, then it's being passed from one person to person. It wouldn't be occurring spontaneously. The thing that's unique about this disease is that the disease agent is not a conventional bacteria or a virus. The best available theory on it is that the disease is caused by something called a prion, which is an infectious protein. It's basically a protein that is produced normally by the body that becomes it changes its shape, and in the process of changing its shape, it acquires the ability to transmit the disease to others. And one of the theories is that this misformed prion protein occurs spontaneously, sometimes through sporadic mutation in every species that has the prion protein. And it turns out that every mammalian species they have looked at has the prion protein.
Hmm.
What that means is that this is a disease that you would expect to occur spontaneously in every mammalian species, whether it be cows or sheep or pigs or humans, and that's what makes this a very difficult disease to control and study, because with most diseases you can say, okay, we can quarantine infected animals and just make sure they don't pass the disease on to others. But with this one, even if you do a quarantine, you always have the risk that it's going to pop up in occasional rare individuals who have never been exposed to the disease.
Hmm. I have a couple calls here, and I want to make sure those people know that I'm not going to make them wait forever. But maybe let me ask one further question, and we can try to get into the details further. And that is how it is that an individual would come into contact with BSE. It's, again, my understanding that you apparently find these things, the things that cause the disease, in some parts of the animal, but not all parts, that, for example, milk and meat from animals known to be infected were given in the laboratory to rats, and they didn't get BSE. And so the thinking is that, in fact, it has something to do with how the animals are processed, what happens to the various parts. And then for that reason, for example, we would say, well, if, you know, maybe you shouldn't, you might want to worry if you ate a hot dog, but if you ate a steak, probably you would be okay. Should people think about this, this big issue of meat products and what sort of risk they may be running by eating them?
Well, there are higher risk and lower risk parts of the animal. This is the bovine spongiform encephalopathies, or the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies in general, are diseases that affect the brain and the nervous system. So brains and nerves are the parts of the body that are most likely to have high concentrations of these prion proteins and to be capable of transmitting the disease if you ingest them. So eating brains is not a very good idea. But the entire body, of course, your muscles throughout your body need a nerve supply in order to function. So, and for that matter, they have found detectable levels of the prion protein in the blood. So there is no part of the animal that you can say is 100% certain to be free of the disease. What you can say, though, is that there are certain parts that are more likely to be risky, and from a practical standpoint, it's much less risky to consume just the meat of the animal than it is to consume something like the brain or the pituitary gland. And as for milk, I'd say I don't see anyone from the scientific community expressing a lot of concern about milk.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have some callers I want to bring into the conversation. We're talking this morning with Sheldon Rampton. He's an investigative journalist. He works for the Center for Media and Democracy puts out a quarterly newsletter called PR Watch. In addition to that, he is the co-author of several books the center has published, including one dealing with the subject of mad cow disease, titled Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here?, published in 1997. In addition, he has written articles for publications, including Harper's, The Nation, In These Times, and has been interviewed or quoted in some of the major broadcast and print media in this country. He's talking with us by telephone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana, folks. We do also have, though, a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. First caller is locally. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could tell me if it's a cumulative effect or if it's a single exposure. And also, if you could comment more on dairy products and how risky they are. I know you said that they're relatively low risk, but compared to a steak, would they be less risk than a steak, or just compared to the brain, would be less of a risk?
Okay, the first question was I didn't hear all of that. That was
Is it a matter of being infected once, or is it a cumulative effect? So the more prions you happen to ingest, the more likely.
Well, when they've done experiments with animals, it's basically the more you're exposed to, the greater your chances of getting the disease, and the more you're exposed to. If you expose an animal to a lot of it, of course they'll come down with the disease somewhat faster than they would otherwise. So there is a cumulative issue of you know, each time you consume something that's infected with this, you're rolling the dice. But in terms of the relative risk of, I don't think anyone has a real good way of quantifying the amount of risk, but I would say that there's an order of magnitude difference between something like brain and something like meat, and then I'd say there's probably another order of magnitude difference between meat and something like milk, so that milk would be considered relatively safe. But I should also add that that the risk to people in this country from mad cow disease at this point is probably not huge. Our concern as journalists writing about mad cow disease so far has not been that we think people need to change their diets in the United States because of this disease. Our concern is that we feel that the government regulatory agencies and the beef industry are not doing enough to protect the public against the potential emergence of this disease in the United States. The other thing I would say, too, is that if you're trying to protect yourself from this class of diseases, I don't think looking for specific products to avoid is even a very effective strategy. For example, in England, at least one of the people who has died from exposure to mad cow disease was a lifelong vegetarian, and no one knows how she got it. But one of the things that happens with the animals we kill for food is that we also process their bodies through rendering into a variety of products that most of us don't think of as meat, such as cosmetics or vaccines or even things like industrial lubricants. And so there are a variety of pathways through which you could be potentially exposed to this disease agent that don't even involve something where a food that you would consume. And for that reason, we think that the attention really ought to be not on what products you avoid or what products you use, but rather on making sure that the government agencies and the food and the people who produce our food are doing what they should to keep this disease from spreading here.
Thank you. And is it also true that regular sterilization processes would not eliminate the prions?
Right. This disease is extremely resistant to sterilization procedures that would kill any known living organism. And that's, again, because this is not a living organism. This is a prion protein. It's not a virus or a bacteria. So conventional disinfectants will not affect it. They've done experiments involving not just disinfectants, but heat treatment, where they've heated up infected tissue to such a level that it reduced it all to just fine ash, and the infectious agent survived without really being affected. So one of the problems for this is that in England they've had to cancel a number of tonsillectomies, and the reason is that the instruments they use to perform the tonsillectomies they are worried will come into contact. If they do one tonsillectomy on someone who's infected, then their surgical instruments will become infected. And then when they perform the tonsillectomy on someone else, since there's no good way to disinfect their instruments, they risk transmitting the disease onto their next patient. In England right now, they are working on a way to come up with basically they're trying to manufacture new disposable surgical tools so that they don't have to worry about transmitting the disease through surgeries.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to, we had another caller. I guess that person changed their mind. Other people certainly are welcome if you want to give us a call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk some more about what happens, what is happening here in the United States as part of the effort to monitor, watch for BSE, and make certain that it doesn't take hold here. We have done a number of things. We have said we're not going to import live ruminants like cows from places where we know there is BSE and other products that are made out of them. We've said you can't import them except under a special permit for scientific research. And we have people around the country that are watching for the disease. Is it, though, your feeling that this doesn't go far enough?
Yeah, in a number of respects. To begin with, although they did stop importing British cattle for a period, there were imports of British meat and bone meal, and that, of course, is a rendered material that disease in England. They do also have a surveillance program. Last year, for example, they looked at some 2,300 cattle brains to see if those cattle were infected, and they didn't find it. The reason that's not an adequate test is that this is a disease which, first of all, you may not find when you just do an autopsy. When you do an before the disease reaches the stage at which you find these microscopic spongiform holes in the brain, the animal may be infected at a subclinical level. Secondly, the surveillance is not adequate because just looking at 2,300 brains is not enough to rule out the possibility that you may have the disease occurring at a low rate of incidence, such as 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000. And as we mentioned earlier, this is a disease that is thought by some scientists to just occur spontaneously in all animals at a rate of about 1 in a million. So the surveillance alone is not enough to protect against the disease. That's sort of like by the time you detect the disease through surveillance, it's going to be too late. And in fact, I was talking to a British scientist a few years ago, back when the United States was doing nothing but surveillance, and he said, "This is just crazy. That's just waiting to find out that you've left the barn door open." And unfortunately, the other practices that need to be done are they have taken some steps to their credit. They announced 3 years ago, about the time our book came out, that they were imposing a ban on the feeding of mammalian proteins to cows and other ruminant animals. Unfortunately, the regulation they announced had some very serious glaring loopholes, and also, unfortunately, we've found out in the last year, it's been reported in the New York Times and elsewhere, that the regulations they put out in 1997 are not being monitored or observed in many cases. So there are quite a few loopholes right now in the existing procedures that should be in place to protect the public.
We have other callers here, and we will go next to a caller in Winnebago, in line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question that relates directly to the last explanation. When I was a boy, the University of Illinois was very explicit about you never fed tankage or bone meal or blood meal to ruminants. So when did it become permissible to start doing that? It must have been after I got out of school. What's the history on it, do you know?
Well, it actually has a pretty interesting history. The part that gets rendered is rendering plants are the places where they take all the parts of the animals that can't be turned into some other usable product, such as, I mean, you can take the skin of the cow and use it for leather, or you can, you know, process the meat out of it, but then you have all these other leftover parts that don't have any commercial value, and you also have some other things like restaurant waste and dead zoo animals and things like that, and so to dispose of all of that, they put them in these big rendering plants and basically grind it all up and cook it down and produce various products from it, including what they call rendered meat and bone meal. One of the reasons that this came into use as something that was being fed to livestock is that they used to take a lot of this stuff and process it into soap. But then the advent of synthetic soaps derived from petroleum kind of wiped out that market for the renderers. So they started looking for other uses for this material and came up with the idea that it could be, because there are a lot of proteins and fats in the products in this rendered material, that this could be something they could market as a feed supplement to chickens and cows and pigs and so forth. And so they started doing that quite a bit, really, I think, beginning in the 1970s. And into the 80s, and it's something that that really took off at that time. And they didn't come across any kind of problem with it, of course, until the outbreak of mad cow disease in England in the 1980s.
Well, thank you. Once again, we shoot ourselves in the foot with science, I guess.
Well, that's sort of what's going on. I mean, when you look at this, it's not a big high-tech change that anyone has made. It's just they took this stuff that that people thought would be safe to feed to animals, and they didn't anticipate that this bizarre type of disease, this, the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, might be lurking in the background waiting to emerge if they did that.
I appreciate the caller's question. Let's go to somebody else here. This is Champaign County, and it's line one. Hello?
I had a couple of points, but on the last point, it seems like it came up at the same time that the overfishing of the Peruvian anchovy, the fish meal supplement, was widely used after World War II, but it was overfished so quickly it actually changed the whole ecology of the off the coast of South America. But and they needed some protein source after that was used up. But what I wanted to ask you about was a couple of things, and I'll have to hang up and listen. Is who are there scientists that are studying like the idea of alternate vectors for this? Right now, as far as we know, the prion actually just goes by people eating, consuming beef or meat. But I gather there is a rather scary, maybe it's a marginal possibility that there could be another way that it might spread. I don't know, attached to a virus or something. That's kind of scary. But the other point was just, since you're with PR Watch, I would like for you to put the context of how you think the meat industry is responding to this, I think, and the government too, for that matter, that it's more of a responding to it as a public relations problem of getting people not to worry about eating beef, a la Oprah suit. But with the FDA as decimated as it has been for decades, several, I guess, since Reagan, that though it might have started before that, I don't know. And this whole idea that government can't do anything, that public health is sort of pretty much abandoned in this country. How can we have any assurance that anybody is monitoring with any kind of effectiveness? I assume the social democracies in Europe are more intrusive and consequently might be looking a little harder or something. I don't know if you can deal with that broad of a scope, and I'll hang up and see.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Well, I don't know anything about Peruvian anchovies, but the question of what's spreading this disease, there is still some scientific debate about the prion theory. Some scientists think that there is some kind of a virus involved. The problem is they've never been able to identify such a virus. This is a disease that, for example, produces no antibody response. One of the things to always bear in mind when you're talking about this class of diseases is that it's a very difficult disease to study. It's very dimly understood, even by the best scientists. And so anything that anyone, including me, tells you about it, you should take with a grain of salt. And that's one of the reasons it's hard also to deal with from the point of view of public health, because it's very hard for scientists to know what they're talking about when they try and set policies in terms of what's safe enough and what's going to avoid all the channels through which this disease might come at you. So, for example, the American Red Cross a little while ago issued a policy basically saying that they were not going to accept blood donations from people who'd lived in England during the period that this epidemic has emerged in cattle, because some of those people would be donating blood who presumably had eaten British beef. Some people criticized the Red Cross and said that's, you know, the likelihood of it being transmitted through blood is pretty low, and that's being ridiculously overprotective. I think it's actually a reasonable thing for the Red Cross to do because of the many uncertainties that surround this disease. Now, as to the other question with regard to how this is being managed as a PR campaign, I think the lawsuit that the National Cattlemen's Beef Association brought against Oprah Winfrey is a good example of the PR campaign that's been waged against public discussion of this disease. If you look at the writings of the beef industry and its consultants, they are scared to death that the public will talk about this. They're afraid that everyone's going to start boycotting beef and no one will eat hamburgers anymore, and that will be a disaster. So one of the things they did a few years ago was they joined forces with some other people in the food and meat industries, and they got laws put on the books in 13 states called agricultural product disparagement laws, which are what, and that's the law that Oprah Winfrey was sued under in Texas. The laws basically say that if you say something that is construed as disparaging about an agricultural product such as beef, then you can be sued and convicted unless you can prove that what you said is scientifically sound, whatever that means. The problem, of course, in talking about this disease is it's impossible to prove that anything you say about it is scientifically sound because it's such a complicated disease. In the case of the Oprah Winfrey trial, she won the trial, but she had to spend millions of dollars and a lot of her time in defending herself. Most people who are interested in writing about this disease, most journalists don't have the kind of money that Oprah Winfrey has. And after her lawsuit began, we saw a real chilling effect in the way journalists talked about this disease. We had quite a few reporters say to us that they were interested in the story, they'd read our book, they wanted to do something about it, but they were afraid that if they did, they would be sued. So that's one aspect of the public relations campaign. There's an ongoing effort to sort of chill speech and also to tell journalists that it is irresponsible scaremongering just to talk about this subject. The other aspect of it is that industry groups, in collaboration actually with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, have set up sort of crisis response teams consisting of scientists and others who are ready on a moment's notice to be mobilized to tell the public about how stringent all the regulations are and how they've never detected a case in the United States, and there's no real problem here. They also have contingency plans in the event that a case is detected in the United States, where they will say at that point, well, it's only one case, and we have very stringent regulations in place to keep it from spreading further, and so forth. And every time you see this issue start to pop up in the news, these government scientists and industry scientists also start to mobilize and to put their word out. They're very organized about doing that.
We just have about 15 minutes left, and we have some other callers, and I want to try and give them a chance. And again, I guess I should introduce our guest. We're talking with Sheldon Rampton. He is editor of PR Watch, a quarterly newsletter published by the Center for Media and Democracy. He's also written articles for other publications, including Harper's and The Nation and In These Times. He is the co-author, along with John Stauber, who also works at the Center. In fact, he was the founder of the Center for Media and Democracy. He's the co-author of several books, including one that deals with this topic. It was published first in 1997, the title Mad Cow USA. It's published by Common Courage Press. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. The next person up here in line is someone locally here, line two. Hello.
Yeah, one, I was wondering if you knew anything about the what I've read that in the early 80s, CJD was spread among humans who were taking human growth hormone, and that a similar thing has happened with new variant CJD, in that some cows were used to their extracts from their pituitary glands was a transmitting agent, and they were trying to come up with a super cow.
Well, I don't know anything about pituitary glands and super cows, but you're correct that one way this disease has been transmitted to people is through the use of human growth hormone as a treatment for people who suffered from dwarfism. You know, people whose bodies didn't naturally produce enough human growth hormone were given treatments, and the way they would derive the human growth hormone was by extracting it from the pituitary glands of cadavers. This practice, by the way, is no longer occurring. A few years ago, they came up with a way of making synthetic human growth hormone. But what happened is that in order to produce enough human growth hormone to treat people, they would actually go around and pay funeral homes a certain fee for each pituitary gland that they extracted from the people they were burying. And it wasn't much money, but they would get thousands of these pituitary glands that way, and then they would pool them all together in a single batch in order to produce this human growth hormone extract. In the process of pooling it, though, they also amplified the risk of transmitting the disease, because if you were to take the pituitary gland from one cadaver, the likelihood of that one person having Creutzfeldt Jakob disease is pretty small. But when you take thousands of them and pool them all together in a batch, you're contaminating that whole batch with the infectious agent.
And it doesn't take very much of that infectious agent to transmit the disease.
Right, it takes very little. And so in the process, they've basically. There's a large class of people in England and the United States and other parts of the world who were treated when they were children for problems with their growth using this thing, and some of them are still waiting to this day to find out whether they're going to get the disease. What they did was they took I think the odds of getting the disease are something like 1 in 100 among the people who were treated with human growth hormone during that period.
Well, I did read that there was a similar thing going on for cows, but move on. I got two more questions. I'm going to try to squeeze in. One is that I understand the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food, called MAF,
in England, right?
In England, banned everything except animal blood, gelatin, and tallow, and in particular, gelatin is a problematic because they're not too. I mean, they had very little basis for not banning gelatin, and as I understand it, gelatin can get into everything from cosmetics to candies and cookies and things like that. And I was wondering if you knew anything about what happened, if our regulatory agencies have been particularly cautious about what's involved, what's in our imports from Britain in terms of gelatin and tallow, for example?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And, you know, gelatin does end up in everything. It ends up, for example, in the gel caps and the medicines you take. The regulatory agencies back in around 1995 sent out some letters to drug companies, and they said, don't use this stuff from England because it could be contaminated with mad cow disease. They were very emphatic about it. Unfortunately, we just had reported last week in the New York Times that five of the major drug companies ignored that advice. And the New York Times is a big piece about this. What it turns out is not only did they ignore the advice, but the Food and Drug Administration didn't even find out about it until last year, and the New York Times found out about it this year. So a year after the FDA knew that these drug companies were not complying with the advice that they had sent out, the public finds out about it. What that tells you is that the FDA is doing more to protect the reputation of these drug companies that aren't following its advice than it is to protect the public. And even now, although the companies that do this have been identified in that report, the FDA says it can't release the information about which products are affected because of trademark and copyright or patent information about how these products are made, and it would violate the patent rights of these companies to disclose which products have been made using materials from British cattle.
I hope that the caller will forgive me. I know he said he had another question, but we're getting to the point where I only have about maybe 6 or 7 minutes left, and the lines are full, and I want to try to give some other folks a chance. We'll go next to Southern Illinois. It's line number 3. Hello.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm raising my first cow, and I know we're supposedly in low risk, but I've heard conflicting things about, well, what happens to the cow is that they get angry and upset, and they kick, and they're very violent. And then I've heard another person or another thing say that they just lay around, they don't do nothing. Can you tell me what the early possible effects are, and what the also the end results are, I mean, as far as behavior, and also what it looks like or appears to do to humans? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's actually kind of a complicated question because it depends. The British strain of bovine spongiform encephalopathy produces the effects that of where the animal will become aggressive or agitated at first, and then it loses coordination and becomes unable to stand and eventually dies or is put down. However, there's a researcher here in Wisconsin where I live by the name of Richard Marsh who did some experiments a few years back involving transmissible mink encephalopathy, which is a version of this disease that was popping up in mink farms. And Marsh came to the conclusion that the mink were getting it from being fed downer cows here in the United States. Downer cows are cows that just, for one reason or another, one day become unable to stand. And that can happen for a variety of reasons. But one reason could be some neurological disease. And Marsh reached the conclusion that these mink that were dying in Wisconsin were getting the transmissible mink encephalopathy from being fed downer dairy cows in Wisconsin. So the behavior of a downer cow, of course, is quite different from the behavior of getting agitated that you described. Marsh went to the level of taking the transmissible mink encephalopathy and transmitting it back to cows and found that it did indeed produce the symptoms that you'd expect to see in a typical downer cow. So there isn't any one set of symptoms. If you're looking for the British strain of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, it would be agitated behavior. And also I'd say that there are different behaviors in humans. One of the ways they recognize the new variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in England is that people who come down with that develop somewhat different symptoms than from conventional Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
Well, is the only way to do a definitive diagnosis of BSE in a cow, for example, to do that post-mortem?
That's the only way to do a definitive diagnosis. They do have some tests now that are becoming fairly good at diagnosing animals even in preclinical stages, but those tests are not 100% accurate.
I'm trying to get at least one more. We'll go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, it's a very short question. What is the chance of getting this disease? Is it like winning the lottery, or is it more prevalent than that?
Right now in the United States, I'd say you're talking about winning the lottery. It's not a huge risk to any given individual. I mean, I always tell people that this is not a disease right now that should cause you to change your eating habits, for example, because the risk to an individual is not that high. The risk right now is to society at large if we don't do something more to prevent the disease from emerging here. And that is a significant risk.
Thank you.
All right. And to Philo for someone else right here. Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Did you discuss the cannibalism of people eating people, such as the Kuru and Papua New Guinea, where considerable incidents has occurred?
We haven't discussed that, but that's really a fascinating story. And we talk about that in our book, Mad Cow USA. One of the first really good pieces of research about this class of diseases was done by a guy named Carlton Gajdaszek, who went to Papua New Guinea and found out that a disease called Kuru had spread to epidemic levels in this class of Stone Age cannibals who were in the practice of consuming their relatives as part of sort of the funeral services. And it's really a kind of a fascinating story, and we go into detail on that in our book. And I before we run out of time, I should just mention that we recently put our book online so that people can download the entire book from our website. So if people want to check that out, the place to go is our website, which is www.prwatch.org.
Does cannibalism occur in the United States among people?
Cannibalism? Well, among Jeffrey Dahmer, it did. But well, and the other thing, of course, is that through medicine and things like heart transplants and organ transplants and blood transfusions, we are basically engaged in a form of high-tech cannibalism. That's one of the concerns about that scientists have raised, is that some of these medical procedures run the risk of transmitting the disease. Of course, that's what did happen with human growth hormone.
I'm going to have to jump in here because we're at the end of the time. We're going to have to stop. I do want to mention one more time that if you're interested in reading some more on the subject, you can look for the book, which our guest has co-authored, titled Mad Cow USA. It's published by Common Courage Press. And as he just mentioned, also they have it on their website of the PR Watch, which is, that's just prwatch.org.
That's correct.
Okay.
PR is in public relations.
And this is the Center for Media and Democracy. They publish this quarterly newsletter, PR Watch. Our guest, Sheldon Rampton, also co-author with John Stauber of these three books, one of them being Mad Cow USA. Mr. Rampton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.